Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to today's segment of Afternoon Satsang. It's a wonderful day today. It is the Ramanavami. Ramanavami is very, very dear to our hearts because of the importance that Swami has given to this festival. In fact, the importance that Swami gives to Rama himself. We find references and quotes of anecdotes from Rama's life in multiple discourses. In fact, Swami has written the entire Ramayana with a totally different perspective, and I think we have also done a detailed afternoon satsang on the Ramkatha Rasavahini. It's amazing. It's such a beautiful day. It's a very significant day, and our duty, our joy and our pleasure to begin by thinking about Ramayana, thinking about Lord Rama. In fact, very coincidentally, because of the lockdown that is in place in India as it is in multiple countries, a version of the Ramayana that we grew up with in the 1980s and 1990s called the Ramanand Sagar Ramayana is coming live twice a day. Not live, I mean, is being broadcast.
Rebroadcast
twice a day on national television, and it's amazing how, you know, a channel that was considered dead and buried, the national broadcaster Doordarshan, has suddenly seen its fortunes revive and it's occupied both the prime times. It just shows that ultimately when it comes to difficult times, times which challenge you, times which demotivate you, times which demoralize you, it is only God. Only God who can rescue you in every sense, whether it is hope, whether it is joy, whether it is peace, whether it's comfort, whether it is solace. Because none of the game shows, none of the sports, none of the entertainment shows, none of them are going as, if I can use the term, viral as the Ramayana is in India today. And it really draws us. I mean, it is such a strong, powerful conclusion. We realize that ultimately in life, this is what matters. My connect with God, my connect with Swami. Because if we actually look at that Ramayana also, that was what both Prem and me were discussing sometime back, that it has been so well made, true to the character of Rama, Lakshmana. I say true to the character because my exposure to Ramayana is more or less Swami's Ramkatha Rasavahini. And as Swami has depicted the different characters there, almost 80 to 90% match is there. And no wonder it feels that it has been inspired by a divine force. That is the reason why it continues to inspire people even to this day. Though the visual effects are quite pathetic in the modern terms, the cinematography or shooting is not filled with rapid cuts. It's not engaging in the technical terms of video production of this day and age. But the heart and soul that has gone into that reflects. That is why Swami would often say that what divinity is Nitya Nutana and Satya Sanatana. It is eternal. It is the eternal truth. And yet it is ever new because it never goes out of fashion. I'm sorry for this outburst, but it is with joy, thrill and excitement of the story of Rama, of the character of Rama, the dharma that Rama epitomizes and the importance that Swami gives to him. And today being Ram Navami, the day of birth of Rama, we just thought that our satsang also should be born with Rama. So welcome, dear listeners, and we shall be going on with the conversations with Sai as we concluded last time. From there we will be taking it on. But before we do that, we offer our humble pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Let's welcome Brother Prem. Sai Ram Prem.
Sai Ram Arvind, and indeed, very warm Ram Navami greetings to all our listeners, and also hoping that everyone is keeping safe. Really, that is one of the most beautiful parts of our childhood, I think. You know, the purity that was there in the media, which we so crave nowadays, and wonderful to see that coming back. And even as we are speaking, I think every week the broadcast of the Ramkatha Rasavahini satsangs are happening. The rebroadcasts, I mean, the satsang that we had done. The very fact that Swami gave, as we have mentioned many times, 7 years of his time writing the Ramkatha Rasavahini, I think over a period of 7 years, the both volumes of Ramkatha were written. I think that is itself a testimony to the fact that how much Swami gave importance to that avatar and what we can learn from the characters of that avatar. Any number of times Swami would say, each character can be taken, analyzed, and so much can be absorbed from the nature of those characters. So I think these are all part of the legacy that we pass on to our next generation. We have mentioned this again many times during the Ramakatha. You know, the culture of a generation gets passed on only through stories. And we are so grateful that our culture has given us stories like this, the Ramayana, the Mahabharata, and the Bhagavatam. And I think it's our duty, even as we equip our children and the next generation with skills which are so important. You know, we teach them communication, we teach them extracurricular activities. If we don't give them these gifts, I think we are crippling them in that in that sense. I think it's a duty of this generation to pass on this. And it's really fascinating to see how the newer generation has accepted a serial which is, you know, which is extremely slow. In fact, even now if we are to see it, the scripting is so slow even for us. But the beauty of the values that it carries and the sensitivity with which the topic has been handled, I think shows that even now a story well told with the right intention can inspire generations to come.
See, that's a very valid point you made, Prem. When this started, and both my parents, they were very nostalgic, and they wanted to watch it. I wanted to watch it because, you know, when it was actually being broadcast in the 80s, late 80s, 1988-89, I didn't know much Hindi at all, and I would never understand. I remember constantly bothering my mother, asking, hey, what did he say, what did he say? Because I would see them getting moved, getting touched, getting, you know, emotional, and I would wonder what happened, what happened. And today it is so beautiful, it is nostalgic for me in the sense that I see my daughter doing that to my parents now. And as you rightly said, though it is apparently very slow moving, it is engaging. My daughter watches it for almost 1.5 hours to 2 hours every day because it's being broadcast twice a day. And I'm so, so happy because this is the story she's picking up and she's able to narrate it. In fact, the interesting thing that happened is after any episode, she wants us to enact it like a drama. And, you know, she, so many questions that come up, whether what is being portrayed on TV is also a drama. It's a drama, but then if that really happened, as per, you know, ages ago, what Rama and Sita did, then she asks, in that age when Rama Sita did, was that also a drama? Now, you know, these questions are multiple layered questions, and I really feel so much can be accomplished in trying to sincerely answer these questions, because when you look at it, Swami says life itself is a drama. So many things, but overall, it's so beautiful. It's such a good change, because the media that otherwise children are accustomed to, including my own daughter, is some cartoons, and which are harmless entertainment. But here it is providing entertainment along with deep set values, which are so vital, because Swami says a child is like a creeper, you know, at a tender age, it needs to be protected and shaped, because once any bend or something comes in a growing plant, that bend remains forever. And when the plant becomes big, you can't straighten it. It will break the plant. You have to do all the straightening at a tender age only. And really grateful to Swami, grateful to wonderful devotees with such noble thoughts who have made such production on such stalwart characters, that really gives so much hope and joy. And that is one very, very big positive I'm looking at in this whole corona epidemic thing that is happening.
Right. And given that, what you've said, I think it is but a beautiful opportunity to go back into Swami's words. In fact, what Swami is saying is about some very essential aspects of our spiritual progress, some exercises that we, I'm sure most many of us might be already doing. This is going to be a recap of what Swami is, what we've heard from Swami before, and probably a bit of a enthusiasm boosting words that we're going to hear from Swami. But before that, before we come to that part, continuing with what Swami was saying last week, Hislop asked a question where he says, we were speaking, I think, about
death.
We were speaking about Namasmarana, the last thoughts that one has, and how one has to practice it throughout one's life to be able to recall God and God's name in the last moments. In continuing with that conversation, Hisla Pass, Swami says that God acts to save the devotee from perdition. What is meant by perdition? And Swami replies, what do you understand from the word? Hislop replies, it seems to me that it means hell. Swami answers, that is just mental. Hislop says, but Buddha speaks of hell as being a place. Swami replies, it is a place, but a place of the mind, a mental state in which there is much worry and suffering. It is an after-death state. Sai is here to guide his devotees so they do not fall into that state. So it's a very beautiful conversation. This concept of perdition, I think a belief system which says that it's eternal damnation kind of a thing. You know, there is no concept of that in Sanatan Dharma. There's always an opportunity to pull yourself up because it is believed that essentially you're divine. You know, the non-divine state or being non-divine is a temporary thing. What is truth is that you're divine. So at some point you will be able to gather yourself up. It might take many lifetimes, it might take thousands of lifetimes, but this is the ultimate destination. So Hislop asks about Swami saving his devotees from perdition, and Swami saying and goes into a discussion about hell itself. From what Swami has said, I think in some other Vahinis, what Swami says is just like how when you go into a dream state, when you're sleeping, that is your body is still there. The mind and the senses are withdrawn from the physical body. And it is like the mind now creates a world of its own where you experience what you have gone through in the day and what it pulls out from the subconscious mind. It creates a dream. It creates a world of its own. And then there is an experience. Yes, there is. You experience fear. You experience happiness. You experience all kinds of emotions within this created mental world. Swami says a very similar thing happens after death. You know, when the body is discarded, now this mind and the senses, which is now referred to as the subtle body. Swami says, now this projects a world depending on what karmas have been done, which is heaven or hell as we refer to it. And that emotion is undergone. It is nothing like a place, like how it is typically depicted in movies, that you are dragged to a particular place and you're made to undergo, there are appointed people who put you through torture or they come and reward you, if you're in heaven. There's nothing like that. Swami says, it's just like how you experience a dream state. This is also a mental state where you suffer or you're rewarded. And Swami would often say, it's like the parliament, right? You get elected and go to the parliament. After 5 years, you have to come and get re-elected. Swami says, heaven is like that. Don't think that you've done good and you reach heaven, you'll be there for eternity. You will again have to come and earn that place again.
In fact, I think it's in the 8th chapter of the Sathya Sai Vahini where Swami says this. And Swami says, all of this depends on the desires that you have. And Swami says that you use words to express desire. You use words to express thoughts. Swami says words show everything. You can't think without words. So words are so important. And that's why, the last words, they say that your last words determine what your future life is going to be. So Swami says that if you have been totally dedicated without bothering, if you have done all your karma without craving for the fruit of the karma, offering everything to God, Swami says when the moment of death comes, your words merge into your mind, and the mind merges into the Atma. And Swami says that the mind, the Atma travels to the solar world. That's what Swami says. Solar world is a world from where you don't come back. So that's it. It's eternal bliss forever. Swami says that instead of that, if you had desires, you had that you want to achieve something, you want to do that. So in that case, what happens is Swami says it goes to the lunar world Chandraloka. And Swami says that the Chandraloka is representative of the mind because it is said Chandrama Manaso Jataha. The presiding deity of the mind is the moon. So there, like you said, like a dream state, all the good is, you enjoy all the good. But Swami says that in that Chandraloka, you are not able to finish your karmas. And you have karmas because you did your act with body consciousness or mind consciousness, whatever, not with the atmic consciousness. So once all the good is completed in the Chandraloka, you have to return back to the earth, return back to this loka to work out your negative karmas. And Swami categorically states that there is nothing like hell. There is a heaven where you enjoy the good of, where you enjoy all the good that you have done with body consciousness. If you have done all the good without body consciousness, that's it. That is what we call Jivan Mukti or liberation or whatever. That is the Surya Loka, Swami says. But if you have done it like a normal person with body attachment, but you have done good, you enjoy all the fruits of that good in Swarga, but you return back to work out your other karmas. And as I said, Swami categorically says that there is nothing like Naraka. But Naraka was conceptualized and created by different religions.
Mm-hmm.
Just to instill fear so that you keep doing good. Either you see what Swami says there is, when you do good with body attachment, you get Swarga. If you do it without body attachment, you get liberated. So in order to encourage people to do good always, this concept of Naraka was created as an opposite of Swarga. But Swami says no, there's nothing like that. There is Swarga and there is earth. That's all it is. That is what Swami says in the 8th chapter of Satya Sai Vahini.
In fact, talking about that Surya Loka and Chandra Loka, Swami would say that this is what is referred to as true Uttarayanam. It is not about the earth moving closer to the sun or northward or anything like that. Swami says the true Uttarayanam is when your life is moving towards the Surya Loka or the liberation and away from Chandra Loka, which is nothing but an extension of your pleasures in the earth.
Hmm.
Swami would say that that is the spiritual shift which actually has to happen. And
I think that is the reason why they also say that Jantunam Narajanma Durlabham.
Right.
Because even from Swarga, there is no way to, even from that heavenly state where there is only happiness and pleasure, like you said, it is there as long as you exhaust all the karmas that you have done, the good karmas. Once all the good karmas are exhausted, you have to come back. So, therefore, in that sense, heaven is not some very special place. It's just a place where you keep deriving pleasure after pleasure. And that's why I think in many discourses, I was going through multiple discourses where Swami has referred to heaven and hell. Swami says, heaven is nothing but your happiness. Hell is nothing but your sorrow. So, though it is there like this, in practical experience, it's nothing but this. Only way to go beyond heaven and hell is to go beyond joy and sorrow. And that's why Swami would, I think, define true devotion as being equanimous, being unaffected by either sorrow or joy. Because I think that is the way we start proceeding towards Surya Loka or towards Jivan Mukti.
You know, even as Swami was saying here, that the confidence which Swami is giving by saying that, you know, Sai is here to guide his devotees so they do not have to fall into that state.
Hmm.
I mean, any number of incidents and experiences can be narrated. In fact, probably we'll share something that we got to hear just yesterday. You know, when Swami chooses to go to the rescue of a devotee, nothing stops. And who is a devotee is only defined by Swami. I think you and I cannot ever define that. For those of our listeners who might already be knowing, I think one of the initiatives that Swami's organization has taken in these times is to set up that quarantine ward opposite the super specialty hospital. In fact, the hospital has set it up as part of its efforts to help the government. And apparently it is one of the largest quarantine wards set up by any private institution. It is actually the Sevadal building. The Sevadal have all been shifted to the ashram, I think, and those wards have been converted into special wards where, you know, suspected patients and people who need treatment for this can be housed. And that is being manned by the government completely. We only set up the ward and given the material required, and that is being manned by the government doctors. So apparently yesterday there was one policeman who was posted there. You know, all of these facilities are being taken care of the government for various reasons. So this policeman, first time he's being posted here, and he comes to our super specialty hospital. He has breakfast in our canteen, and he goes to this ward to begin his duty on that first day of his posting, and he just collapses. And they immediately rush to the super specialty hospital. They check and they find that he's had a massive heart attack. And immediately, within 2 hours, a procedure is performed, and a stent has been put.
Wow.
And Dr. Iyer, who did the procedure, he was saying, can you imagine what happened to this man? Given the situation the entire state and the country is in, he could have collapsed anywhere. There's no possibility of him being taken to a medical center and a procedure like this being done instantly given the situation the country is in today. Imagine he had to be posted on that particular day, you know, opposite Swami's hospital, and within 2 hours, be in Parthi, we cannot say that we'll probably get that kind of a treatment immediately, you know, unless Swami exactly. wills it in that way. I mean, he's saying that what grace of Swami was there on that policeman, that everything falls into place. And, you know, he was saying that, see, as doctors of Swami, we've seen many like this, but every now and then you see like this, you know that, you know, Swami knows, Swami is exactly arranging things so precisely to take care of people. And, you know, we think that we have set up the center, we are taking care of this place. Swami knows exactly who has to be given what treatment and what grace at what time. And it's just clockwork precision when it comes to Swami.
You know, that policeman, as you said, did not even...
Probably this is the first time he's coming to Parthi. We never know.
I was just going through some of the videos that we have posted on Radio Sai, and there was one video on Swami coming in dreams. So I was going through the comment section, and there was one comment from a person. He said that, you know what, I am not a Satya Sai Baba devotee. I have never visited Puttaparthi also. But the strange thing is, this person came in my dreams. He came 2-3 times. And then he says that one time when he came, he healed me of my heart problem. So he says, so from then on, I have got now respect and regard. But I am still not a devotee. I don't know whether I deserve it, but I got it. It's amazing. I read that and I felt so thrilled, because, you know, I think it's in our minds that we make these distinctions, Sai devotee, non-Sai devotee, nothing like that. It is the flow of compassion. The Lord is universal. As media, it is our responsibility and duty to spread more and more of such positive stories, such good things everywhere, because good begets good. You know, what goes around comes around. That's what it is. If we focus, see, Swami also is clearly saying here, hell and heaven are in your mind. It's what you focus on, where you. So we can create our own living hell. We can create our own living heaven by choosing what we focus on. And such stories, you know, such this comment, this story, what happened, all these just motivate us to think more deeply about what we are creating around us through our thoughts, words, and through our deeds.
Right. I think probably we'll just take a quick break at this point, because the discussion is changing a little after this. And a very beautiful and important point is being stressed by Swami. It would be very helpful for many of us, not only during this lockdown, definitely during this lockdown, but even otherwise, I think, as a practice that we can take up for the rest of our lives. But we will do that after we take this short break. Dear listeners, we'll play a small song for you. Do come back after that.
Antarangamuna, Aparamudanata, Rupamuna, Vintalu Sarupaga, ಸುತ್ತಲು ಸಲು ಭಗ ಅಂತ ರಾಮಮಯೋ ಈ ಜಗಮಂತ ರಾಮಮಯೋ ಷಡ್ವರ್ಗಮು ಅಷ್ಟ ದಿಕ್ಕುಲುನು ಆದಿಶೇಷುಡುನು ಅಷ್ಟವಸೂಲುನು ಹರಿ ಷಡ್ವರ್ಗಮು ಅಂತ ರಾಮಮಯೋ ಈ ಜಗಂ ಅಂತ ರಾಮಮಯೋ ತಾರಕನಾಮಮು ಇರುಡು ಭದ್ರಾಚಲ ರಾಮದಾಸುನಿ ಕೋರಿಗಲೋ ಸಗಡಿ ತಾರಕನಾಮಮು ಅಂತ ರಾಮಮಯಂ ಈ ಜಗಮಂತ ರಾಮಮಯಂ ಅಂತ ರಾಮಮಯಂ ಜಗಮಂತ ರಾಮಮಯಂ ಅಂತ ರಾಮಮಯಂ ಈ ಜಗಮಂತ ರಾಮಮಯಂ ಈ ಜಗಮಂತ ರಾಮಮಯಂ ಈ ಜಗಮಂತ ರಾಮಮಯಂ
Welcome back, dear listeners. We will continue with the reading. Hislop now asks Swami. Swami points out that we already have and use a very high order of concentration in our daily lives. Then why is concentration not automatic in spiritual practice? And Swami responds, without concentration, nothing can be done. And we use that concentration throughout the day. Why is that same concentration so difficult to come by in spiritual matters? Because the mind is outward turned, and by desire, the mind clings to objects. But the mind can be trained to concentrate inwardly, and the heart can be cultured to grow with love for God. How? By sadhana. The best sadhana is that every act through the day be done as worship of God. Such a simple solution. Yet it's not simple to practice, to do everything as an offering to God. I mean, the kind of feelings we have while we place flower and light agarbatti and the lamp in the altar compared to, say, sweeping our own homes, which I think most of us are doing now because we don't get our maids or anything. So, when I look at my own example, I feel a kind of, you know, close to Swami. I feel it so beautiful. I'm in the altar. I'm doing this, especially today because it is Ram Navami. But while sweeping, it's taken as a chore. I do it, but I don't think I will be sad if that is taken away from me. But at the same time, if this act of lighting an agarbatti in front of Swami is taken away from me, maybe I'll feel sad. So it clearly shows what a difference we have and how much we have to travel still to reach the level where we consider everything as Swami's work. In fact, I very distinctly remember all of us Sai Sannidhi members, meaning all those alumni who have decided to work in Swami's institutions in Vrindavan, Parthi, elsewhere, all of us, we have our Sai Sannidhi day. We gathered in the bhajan hall and we all prayed to Swami, saying that, Swami, this is the 85th birthday. really it's very special, it's a landmark birthday and we want to do something special. What is the special thing you would like us to do, we would love to do? You know, we felt it will be a, it's a privilege that we are getting this opportunity to directly ask Swami, Swami, what is it that you want? And it's also a privilege and pleasure that we get to do that. But Swami's response was, he said, Bangaru, you know, dear ones, you've all got your different jobs, right? Wherever, whatever job you're doing, do that correctly and perfectly. That's what I want. So, you know, not just, that was the second time Swami was saying like that. Two times we have tried to ask, and both the times Swami has said the special gift is whatever you're doing, do it as Swami's work. And then when we examine our own attitude and behavior in our own workplaces, how many times we get angry, how many times we get frustrated. If we think about how many times we would be getting such thoughts or getting such feelings if we were, say, doing Padaseva for Swami, never. Then why are we getting it in our workplace? Because we don't take work as worship. And Swami says the best sadhana is to do work as worship. Whatever you're doing, do it for Swami. That is what will bring joy. That is what will also solve so many dilemmas. Because, you know, recently in one or two online talks that we are having because of the lockdown, a question that was asked was, I would love to dedicate myself fully for Swami's work, but, you know, the timings clash. I'm not able to do the organization work. I'm not able to do this because it means I will have to bunk my office work. You know, is that fine? Which should I give importance to? And that is when I remembered this, what Swami had told in Sai Sannidhire preparations, wherein Swami clearly said that whatever work, don't take it as housework, office work, Swami's work. Everything is divine work. Everything is Swami's work. Then where is the question of, is this important, that is not important? Swami said, do everything as Swami's work. Automatically you will know what you have to do. Do your duty. Duty is God.
Right. I think it's more of holding yourself up to a higher standard. You know, as you rightly said, sometimes when you break it down to activities, it's easy to tell a mother that whatever you are doing for your family, do it as Swami is, as an offering to Swami. But if you break it down to a small activity of cleaning a closet, or, you know, you're disciplining the child at one moment, breaking it down like that probably might be difficult. But overall, when you're doing it as an activity, as you're working in the corporate, you hold yourself to a higher standard of expectations, not because anybody's looking at you, not because, you know, at the end of the day, somebody's going to question you, but the person you're reporting to is somebody more than anyone in front of you. Right? That's what makes it an offering to God. You know, when Swami was physically available, as you were rightly saying, that when we were offering something to Swami, automatically, whether we want it or not, we will think that, you know, will this please Swami, right? That's how we would do it. You know, something as simple as an opportunity we used to have in the hostel of cooking for Swami, sometimes during vacations or when Swami is there. There used to be a department which had the opportunity to send a carrier of food from the hostel for Swami's lunch. Swami would never eat it, but automatically when you're cooking for Swami, you will think, you know, you'll think of Swami's taste. It's something that is absolutely a piece of illusion that we are creating, that Swami likes something and not does not like something. But then it makes you think that, you know, this taste will be more likable to Swami. As we have narrated one incident so many times, you know, when Swami had gone to the Kodaikanal for the first time, Swami wanted spicy food and everybody else was scared of eating spicy food. But eventually you think that, you know, this is what Swami likes, so we will have it. As one of the old devotees was saying, that in the 60s and 70s, they had no clue when Swami would travel. There would be no notice. All of a sudden, one day you would find Swami's car parked in the porch. You know, this was the days when sands and even the decorations that the mandir right now has was not there. The old time when it was just like a typical old bungalow, right? Prashant Nilayam. So if the car, if Swami's car comes and gets itself parked in that porch, which means Swami is going. And it could be Swami is going to Anantapur or Swami is going to Hyderabad or Chennai. You never know. So whenever Swami's car would be parked there, apparently this devotee of Swami, Peddabottu, she would bring two, you know, those old days, they used to have this tin, oil tins, right? Even now we use even it for storage, right? So she would bring two of those and keep it there. And that would have some nippertos or murukos for Swami's travel. Which means that it would be ready throughout the year, because you never know when Swami is traveling. So the moment Swami's car comes there, she would bring one or two of those tins and keep it there. And Swami will look at it and say, oh, keep it. And the devotees who have traveled with Swami would say that nobody other than Swami can eat that Nipotu because it is to be so spicy. It would be made to Swami's Rayal Sima taste, right? But she used to make that because she is making for Swami. So the moment you think that I am doing something for Swami, you automatically look beyond your likes and dislikes, your idea of what is right and wrong, and you look at Swami's, will this be approved by Swami, as one of our old students was saying, that in his corporate life, people will come and ask him, why are you doing this? This is beyond your, call of duty. You would say, but I'm reporting to a different boss. You know, you will not understand. At the end of the day, I know whom I'm reporting to, and he expects me to do this. You know, the person who's giving me the salary doesn't expect me to do it, but the real boss whom I'm reporting to expects me to do it. So I think it's that idea of, when you say offering everything to Swami, and Swami is saying here that that itself is a meditative process. See, every activity that you do needs concentration. So as Swami was saying, that that's the lower level. But if you want to raise it to the level of meditation, which is actually a form of worship or upasana, the best means is that whatever you do, do it as an offering to Swami.
Continuing, Swami says, God is like the electric power. The heart is the light bulb. And the wiring is discipline. The switch is intelligence. The act of turning the switch is the morning, noon or evening meditation. Once the electric switch, this wiring and bulb are in, nothing more needs to be done. Just turn the switch and there is light. I think through this, Swami also makes it very clear that before one jumps into the practice of meditation, the electric power is definitely there always. That is God's power. One has to have a pure heart, because Swami says heart is the bulb. And then along with that, you need discipline also. I think that is where devotion and discipline both come in, the two D's. And then the intelligence. Discriminating between what is right and wrong. So the three D's of devotion, discrimination and discipline are essential along with a pure heart before we get into meditation. And Swami explains it in the other way, you know, marketing, saying that that's all it is. Once the electric switch, wiring and bulb are there, all you need to is just put on the switch, which is just do meditation. But getting the wiring, the bulb, the switch, everything in place is the challenge. And if the meditation is done, if you put on the switch without either the bulb, the wiring or the switch itself not being there, I don't think there'll be light.
Right. And it's a very beautiful analogy in that sense. You know, definitely God is all important. But Swami would, whenever he would give an example like this, he would say that it's equally important what the bulb is. You know, what is the wattage of the bulb? Is the bulb in working condition? And the wiring, as Swami says, you have a fantastic bulb and you have unlimited power and uninterrupted power. But what's the use? If there's no wiring, there's no possibility. And so Swami is saying that, you know, when Swami said it is enough if you offer your actions to God, you cannot do that without that feeling. If I do not have the sense that I love Swami and I want to do it for Swami, it's impossible for me to do any activity as an offering to God. And Swami is saying for that you need sadhana. Where will you get that emotion from? Where will that that bhava come from? Swami is saying that comes with disciplined effort, which is sadhana. Swami very clearly said, you know, where you, that sadhana, that of the day we done as worship to God. I'm sorry, because
but mind can be mind trained,
can
to
be
concentrate.
Trained to concentrate inwardly, and the heart can be cultured through sadhana. Swami said, and later Swami would speak about, you know, sticking to the time, and even in the previous two episodes when we were speaking, Swami is talking about the discipline of doing it at a fixed time, at a fixed place, or mentally traveling to that place and doing it. The reason why Swami is saying that is that I think earlier also in an episode Swami says this when Hisla passed, that Swami, I find there's so much of love that I feel towards Swami, and Swami asks, how did you think that love has come? It is because for so many births you have done sadhana. It has not come all of a sudden. It's not that simply you've seen Swami and you felt that love. So I think this is again a question that many people ask. You know, how do I get that love for Swami? How do I get that bhavam? You know, we always say that bhavam is important, but how do you get that? So I think this is the answer that Swami gives. If you really want that, if you treasure that, you get it through this sadhana. There is, you know, always the achievement is very wonderful. You know, it's wonderful to feel that warmth of love in your heart for Swami. But it can be got by this dry practice. You know, there is no escape for that. it's wonderful to be standing on the podium and receiving the gold medal in the Olympics. But how many are prepared to commit themselves for that boring practice? And that's what sadhana is. I'm not saying that sadhana is boring. But sometimes, even if it gets boring, one has to labor through it.
No, really, Prem. Because, you know, whenever I try to do some creative writing, I have myself noticed it. You know, there will be those moments when suddenly you can feel that divine connection, you know, that something is just flowing through. It just flows and it's so beautiful. Right. And that will be like the point which you are sure later on when people read that, they will say, hey, that one was amazing. You know, but that standing alone doesn't affect. You need the whole writing to come through.
Right.
And the rest of the writing can sometimes turn out to be extremely dreary. You know, you sit, knock out a few words, change the sentence. Extremely, it's almost like, you know, nitpicking and boring. And later on, yes, you yourself read the piece and you feel it's wonderful. But you really wonder whether it was so divinely inspired, because there are parts of inspired thought, but there is a lot of boring drilling and, you know, writing itself. That's why, you know, once or twice when people have asked me, how do you become a writer? I really thought about it. And you know, the answer is, you just write.
Right.
You keep writing and writing and writing, you become a writer. Just like if you keep reading, you become a reader. You keep, whatever you keep doing.
So how do you become a sadhaka? Do sadhana,
that's all. It's like, I think, I don't know if it's your email sign off which says, you are what you repeatedly do. You know, I've heard that. I've seen that as somebody's profile message. Mm-hmm. It's so true. You are what you repeatedly do. How to become positive? Repeatedly, we keep being positive. In the beginning, it might be just so tough. I'm just acting as like I'm positive. No problem. That's the start. In the same way, how do I become a writer? Keep writing. Hey, what I've written, it's crap. It may look like scrap, but don't worry. Keep writing. Same way in the sadhana also, I may feel I'm sitting in meditation, because, you know, that's something that I keep trying every now and then. And I feel at the end of the meditation session that I didn't do anything. Possibly I've just touched trying to be concentrated, but nothing I've achieved. But I think that's just the beginning. We have to keep doing again and again and again. When we look at our sages and saints, I think it's also metaphorical when they say that somebody did tapas for 1,000 years. It's not as if like God is testing you for 1,000 years before getting pleased. I think it requires that much effort to get that connection. And Swami says, once that connection is there, God responds instantaneously. But that is why they say that this person did tapas for 1,000 years, 10,000 years, because I think it is an indicator for us to show that it requires a lot of practice.
Absolutely. Even the example that Swami is giving, when all the wiring is done and all the fixtures have been put in place, it only takes that one moment of switching on a light and everybody will say, wow, nice lighting. But we, you know, to get it to that point, the wiring is the tough part, right? The wiring is the one which is, when nobody is looking, you're literally working yourself out. When you're, you know, breaking the walls, laying the wires, that's the toughest part.
And assuming that you bought the wire, what if it's told that you have to dig the ore, extract the metal, make the wire? I mean, that is how it is in spirituality.
Absolutely. So I think that's a very important point, because a lot of youngsters would ask that, you know, initially I found it very interesting to go for bhajans, but now that interest is not there. You know, first few times the seva was very interesting and then it sometimes becomes boring. I think this is the answer for that. Yes, sometimes it will get boring, but I think when you value what is there on the other side of this effort, you have to pull you through that effort, and there will be moments of inspiration. It's not like it's not that you're going to be finding inspiration all through the journey. At the same time, it's not that it'll be boring all through the journey, but you have to pull yourself at the time when you find your spirits dipping.
Forgive me for my fatherly examples. I'm sharing it because that's how I'm learning. You know, for instance, every day, 3 times a day, I eat my food. And sometimes it's the dosa that I love, sometimes it's the upma that I don't like. But I eat a similar quantity of both because I need it. If I don't have breakfast, I know. And especially on Thursdays, I'll eat a little more because I know my lunch is going to be 2 hours late because of the afternoon satsang. But when I look at my daughter, you know, she'll eat nicely what she likes, and what she doesn't like, she just won't eat. We are trying to teach her that, you know what, you skip this lunch, you're not going to get anything till dinner. You don't understand it. I feel she's possibly still not yet understanding the importance of food. Taste, of course, is an add-on. taste, I feel, is like the inspiration that we get. But food, whatever it is, you need the nutrition. So, like that in food, I think we will also get that real. We are also kids. Maybe we are infants, children in the spiritual path. And that's why we think, no, I'll do only what I like. That bhajan I'll attend if X or Y is coming for the bhajan. Otherwise, I won't attend it. Otherwise, it's boring. It's like saying, I will eat food only if there is pasta. Pasta won't be there every day.
Someone is saying, I will listen to afternoon satsang only when stories are being told.
Exactly.
When Swami's message is being discussed, it becomes boring. Yeah, I think it does become sometimes, you know, it's always nice to listen to all experiences of Swami and, oh, Swami did this, Swami did that. We enjoy narrating it as much that I think the whole idea is this transformation, right? As Swami was saying, Swami is trying to catch our attention so that this transformation happens. So if we say that we want only the inspiration part, we'll be inspired and then we'll go back to our worldly life. I think it doesn't work that way.
Exactly. Nourishment, nutrition, and like they say, Rome is not built in a day. Anything that has come to a level where it inspires others, if we actually look back at it, you know, this is, I feel, is also a problem in the way our media depicts things. You know, when they are depicting the story of a superstar, they start off with the initial difficulties and then they fast forward through the efforts. This is what he did. He did this now for 20 years. Okay. Now look what happened after 20 years. When you live through those 20 years, you realize what a huge amount of effort it is. I think to achieve that kind of a result, we need to put in that kind of an effort. And so therefore, as Swami says, do it regularly in the same place. In fact, Swami gives some more tips. Going ahead, Swami says, a fence is placed around a young tree to protect it. The same precautions must be observed in meditation. People think it is all right to meditate in any place. There are currents, there is willpower, there is a strong current passing into the earth. Because of this, the earth exerts a very strong attraction. In meditation, it's advisable to insulate oneself from such currents. For this reason, meditators sit on a plank and cover their shoulders with a woolen shawl. Once the person has grown strong in his meditation, he may sit anywhere and not suffer for it.
Right, I think it's again a very, very important tip that Swami is giving, because we all know that when Swami is speaking about meditation, when Swami is speaking about devotion, these are things that transcend the physical, right? So you don't need anything really to be devoted to Swami. You don't need to come to Prashanta Nilayam in that sense. You don't need to go to a Sai Samiti. But what value that has in our progress cannot be negated in that sense. To a certain extent, we need that. And that is what Swami is saying. I think sometimes we just get a little ahead of ourselves. We want to assess our growth so much that, you know, I don't need this anymore now. And, you know, or read a portion of Swami's discourse where Swami is speaking of what happens, on the other side, and say that we are already there. I think it's very important to say this. In fact, this is again an incident we might have narrated so many times of our lecturer, Professor Anil Kumar, Professor Anil Kumar, Swami's translator, but who was a lecturer in the chemistry department. He used to tell, you know, his father was known for meditating, waking up at 3:30 in the morning and meditating. And he followed this discipline for so many years. I think well through his career. He was in the government working in a very very high position. But all through that, you know, he always maintained this discipline of waking up at 3:30 in the morning and meditating and then going for his duty and all of that. In fact, when he retired, he came and told Swami that, Swami, I want to go away to the Himalayas. And Swami asked him, what will you do in the Himalayas? So he said, Swami, I want to take to my spiritual path more seriously. And Swami asked him, okay, you go to the Himalayas and then you do meditation there or whatever sadhana you do. And the moment comes when you're going to get Atma Sakshatkar, who is going to come and give you that? And he said, Swami, you only have to give me, right? You are the Atman, you are the Brahman, you only have to give me that. Then Swami said, I am here. So he said, okay, Swami, what do you want me to do? So Swami said, you come here. Once you retire, you come here, settle in Parthi. You work in the ashram. And Swami says, when the time comes, I will come and give. Right? And he said, what a great blessing to hear this from Swami. I will give you Atma Sakshatkar, Swami said. And this person, being a true, you know, sadhaka, he said, "Yes, Swami, I mean, I'm not attached to Himalayas. Right? I mean, as a sadhaka, you're only thinking about liberation. And if you say so, I will be happy to come and do that." And Swami said, "Yes, do that. Come and settle here." And that's what he did. I think he was one of the initial PROs of the ashram. Mm. So he was settled here for many years. Swami had given him a room in East Prashanti. And he was continuing his sadhana, waking up at morning 3:30 and doing meditation. And one day Swami calls him inside the interview room and Swami asks him, he said, "How long do you intend to be in LKG?
Then he said,
"Swami, I don't understand what you're saying. No, how many more years you want to be in kindergarten?" So he prostrated to Swami and said, "Swami, please tell me clearly what mistake have I done." Then Swami said, "How long do you want to hold on to this meditation, sadhana and japam and dhyanam and all that?" He said, "Swami, what should I do? I thought this is what will get me to that place." So he said, "Yes, it is true, but it is not necessary anymore." So he said, "Swami, what should I do?" Swami said, "Wake up at 6 in the morning and have a nice cup of coffee. Come out, sit on the balcony." And you know, his balcony overlooks that road where people go to the mandir, the East Prashanti road. Mm. Swami said, "Just sit there. And every individual who passes by that road," Swami said, "look at that person and said, the same Atman which is there in that person is in me too. The same Atman which is there in that person is in me too." Swami said, that much is enough. Right? And when our lecturer narrated this incident to us, he said, "It's very fascinating to hear this, right? Oh, so that's where I have to be. But who can tell when that moment has come? Who can tell that LKG or kindergarten is over and you're ready to go to the next class? The problem with all of us is we're all eager to get there. The moment you hear an experience like this, you want to say that I want to do that. I wake up at 6 in the morning and sit there, have my coffee and then look at each one. Yeah, that's very nice, but what about those 20-25 years of sadhana that devotee has put in for Swami to tell him that now you're ready to graduate, right? So I think sometimes we get ahead of ourselves. I think we can be absolutely sure that when our time has come, when Swami feels that we have done enough of sadhana, Swami will, like Swami did to that devotee, will come and tell us that you have done enough. And now you only have to sit and do bhajans or whatever it is, or you just have to come and do Nagar Sankirtan and go. Whatever it is, that command, Swami will come and give it to us. But till that point, as Swami is saying here, we need that fence. We need that fence of discipline around us, and let us not think too much of ourselves and say that we don't need it anymore. Let Swami decide that.
Exactly, because you know, even a person like Lakshmana, Swami narrates the story often, when they are in exile and they are going through the forest, there comes a point in time when Lakshmana throws down his bow and tells Rama, what stupidity, what colossal stupidity is this? We are saying dharma, and what has this dharma given, and what we are in the forest here? Let's stop all this nonsense, let's get back to Ayodhya, and anyway everybody wants us back there, why are we struggling in the forest? And Swami says that Sita looks at Lakshmana and is shocked. Here's a person who left his wife and followed Rama, never spoke one word against Rama, and now he is criticizing everything that Rama has done so far. What happened to Lakshmana? But Rama only smiles and continues walking, and Lakshmana continues to follow his brother, thinking that he's also not listening to me in that manner. But Swami says after some time, suddenly Lakshmana feels, "Oh God, what did I do? What a nonsensical thing that I spoke. It was so stupid on my part." He says that and he goes and falls at Rama's feet and he says, "Brother, forgive me. I don't know why I did all this." And then Swami says that Rama explains that they were passing through the territory of a demoness. And because of that, the sthala prabhavam, the impact of that place, that is what caused Lakshmana to get such thoughts. And in the discourse, Swami continues every time to say, "Tell me your company, I'll tell you what you are." And by company, it's not just the physical company you keep, it is also the thoughts that you entertain, the places that you go to, desha, kala, paristhiti, the situations that you get into, the words. So, when we say company, it is all this. And that is why Swami says it's so important you insulate yourself from all other influences. Try to have the same place. Try to ensure, you know, it's almost like the kind of social distancing we are practicing now. Spiritually also we need to do that. We maintain the cleanliness of our place, right? I mean, we are always ensuring there is hygiene. We are cleaning it with what do you call that, sanitizer. We are sanitizing the atmosphere, our workplace, wherever we are working. In the same way, spirituality also has to be taken seriously, like that you need to sanitize your place. And just like whatever we do in the physical realm, the same thing has to be done in the spiritual realm. So we need to sanitize, we need to have discipline, we need to put in daily effort, we need to do all that. And these are the tips that Swami gives. He says, try to have a wooden plank or a mat, something. On that note, dear listeners, we will take another break. The thought actually continues, because later on Swami speaks more about meditation. In fact, a lot about Jyoti meditation. I don't know if we'll have time to cover all that today, but right now we'll take a quick little break and come back after that.
ముని దరిచేరితిమి ఆదరించలేవా భక్తుల ముని దరిచేరితిమి ఆదరించలేవా షిరిడిపురి వాస సాయి మహాదేవా షిరిడిపురి వాస శ్రీ సాయి మహాదేవా తల్లివి నీవే తండ్రివి నీవే తాతవు నీవేగా తల్లివి నీవే తండ్రివి నీవే తాతవు నీవేగా అన్నియు నీవే అనినే నమ్మితి నీ బావా ఓ అన్నియు నీవే అనినే నమ్మితి నీ బావా సాయి మహాదేవా కాపాడగరావా ఏ దారి లేక నీ దరి చేరితి ఎట్లు బ్రోతువో తండ్రి ఏ దారి లేక నీ దరి చేరితి ఎట్లు బ్రోతువో తండ్రి పర్తిపురి వాస శ్రీ సత్య సాయి దేవా ఓ పర్తిపురి వాస శ్రీ సత్య సాయి దేవా ఓ సాయి మహాదేవా దేశ దేశములు అంతా తిరిగి బేజారితి నయ్యా దేశ దేశములు అంతా తిరిగి బేజారితి నయ్యా ఈ దివ్యమూర్తిని గాంచి ఎంతో ఆనందమయే బాబా ఓ మీ దివ్యమూర్తిని గాంచి ఎంతో ఆనందమయే కాపాడగరావా ఓ సాయి మహాదేవా కాపాడ
Welcome back, dear listeners. Continuing with the conversation, Hislop then, you know, after Swami tells about how you should insulate yourself from currents using a plank or a wooden shawl to cover your shoulders, Hislop is now bringing up another theme. He says, there must be a second or a fraction between one thought and another, and also between sleep and waking. No doubt that state in between must be something special. Swami says, find out. Continue practice to catch the interval between sleep and waking. Do it with love. Then Hislop says, Swami, seeing a corpse, one can understand that the body has no life of its own. But how can the mind be associated with a body that is inert? I think this comes from the fact or from the point that Swami makes, saying that the mind leaves the body after death and it travels along with the soul. So he's saying that inert body has no life on its own, but how is the mind associated with a body that is inert? And Swami says, there is the inert body, there is a supreme consciousness. And in between the two, there is the mind which is inert but appears to be alive because it is infused with consciousness. Just as with iron, which when heated burns and does so because it is penetrated by fire, thus it is not the iron that burns, it is the fire in the iron that burns. The whole mirage, the whole thing arises from thought, from the identification of I with the body. All troubles and complications arise. Since it is the mind that has woven this web of identification with body, it is a mind that must now turn and seek one's true nature through discrimination, renunciation and inquiry. Both ego and intelligence may be included in the word mind. So mind is, I think, manas, buddhi, chitta, ahankara. That is the mind that is being spoken about. And so Swami beautifully says that body is inert and there is consciousness. The mind is inert but appears alive because it is percolated or permeated by Atma. I think in discourses Swami would also say that the mind is the child of Atma and the speech is the child of the mind. Right. Therefore, speech is the grandchild of the Atma.
Right. And that first portion where Swami is talking about catching that silence between two thoughts, I think that is again one of the practices which many masters have spoken about. The feeling that, you know, when we often talk about silence, when you talk about the divine state, the best example that is often given is, as Swami also would use in discourses, the Adhara and the Adhiya. There's something which is the basis, and on that basis, something has been created, just like something is projected on a wall, or when you paint on a canvas, right? When you look at a painting, you, for a moment, you forget what is it that is underlying that.
The canvas
is not seen. And Swami would say that the divine state is like that. It is not something that you achieve, but it is something that has to be unraveled because which is there. So if you look at that, if you look at it from that point of view, the thoughts that you have are being superimposed on the thoughtless state, which is your real nature. So maybe between those two thoughts, there is that your expression of that divine state. So it is like trying to find that, you know, when you're trying to meditate, can you look at that divine state? In fact, there's a very beautiful episode where one Swami was in the interview room with some students, and Swami, when one of the students asked this question, Swami, what is the state of samadhi which is described in the Upanishads? You know, we read so much about it, but what is it like to be in that state? And Swami paused for a few minutes, and Swami asked this boy who happened to be a gymnast, and Swami asked him, Balti chestav kada, Swami asked. You do that somersault. He said, yes, Swami. So when you're doing the somersault, Swami asked him, when you're mid-air, you know, you've taken the flip, you're mid-air, you've not yet landed, what are you thinking of at that time? And this person, you know, he literally ran that scene in his mind and he said, Swami, probably nothing. You know, at that time you're not thinking of anything really. That's probably a moment when there's nothing running through your mind. And Swami said, that is samadhi. The moment between two thoughts. You know, you've had a thought, whether it's a good thought, bad thought, ego or jealousy, whatever it is, that doesn't matter. There is a thought, and there is a silence, and then there is another thought. And Swami said, that silence is samadhi. And the most beautiful part was Swami said, that which you experience when you're mid-air, when you're doing the somersault, that samadhi I am in all the time. Mm-hmm. So he said, that is the difference, and you're trying to reach that state of that being your natural state and constantly being there.
Going to that painting analogy that you gave, I think a more easier analogy would be like a movie being projected on the
right.
screen. So as long as the movie is being projected, we don't see the screen at all. A moment if there, you know, in the interval when there's a break, we are able to see the screen. So the thoughts can be considered as the projected movie and the screen can be considered as the Atma. So that is why I think there is that, what do you say, that sadhana of trying to notice the moment between two thoughts, because that is like the moment when the projector is not working, when you're able to see the screen.
Right, and it is said that once you see it, you can't unsee it.
Mm.
Right? It's not that the thoughts will stop, it's not that the movie will stop, but once you've got the concept, once you've understood that there is something white and on that whatever is being projected is only a play of light, just like how, you know, once you've gone to a movie and seen a white screen, that image can never be removed.
Hmm.
Now we completely understand what a film is, and they say that that's what is referred to as Jivan Mukti. It's not that the illusion disappears, but you see the illusion as an illusion. Nobody can make you believe that it is real. And I think that is the sadhana that he is referring to, and Swami is answering that, and very, very beautifully that conversation goes on to the nature of mind. Again, this is something Swami would, as he was referring to in the beginning, that is the reason Swami would say the mind is being equated to the moon. Because the moon does not have light of its own, it reflects the light of the sun. Swami would say similarly, the mind does not have any nature, I mean, any sentience or life of its own. It is only borrowing. And again, a very classic Vedantic example of burning iron, where it is said the iron never burns, the iron never glows. But we see the iron glow when the iron is burnt to red hot. So they say that always it is only the fire that is glowing. It's only that the iron is showing that to you. Or the iron becomes a means by which you are able to see heat.
Mm.
Otherwise you can never see heat in that sense. So they say mind is showing you something which cannot be seen otherwise, which cannot be sensed otherwise. And Swami is very beautifully saying that that mind is that. And again, in the satsang that we've done about the nature of the mind, manas, buddhi, chitta, ahankara, Swami would say that everything is the mind. It's just that different forms of
functions,
the same
functions
of the same mind. And Swami is saying that in the last statement. Both ego and intelligence may be included in the word mind. Because as Swami would say, I think it is in the, a few weeks back I was mentioning that on the other program, in the Sankhya philosophy it is believed like that. You know, there is the ultimate, there is the Purusha, and then Prakriti is created, which is nature. And along with that, both of these components are created, ego and buddhi. So now it is, the choice is given to the created, whether you will use ego and go away from the Purusha or use buddhi and turn towards the Purusha. And that's why Swami is saying both ego and intelligence is part of that creation, is part of the mind. Now it is up to the sadhaka.
And the other way also, when you say manas, buddhi, chitta, ahankara, manas is the mind that, you know, keeps going behind pleasurable things, going away from painful things. But not all pleasurable things are good, not all painful things are bad. And in order to distinguish that, you need the buddhi aspect, which is the discrimination.
Right.
And then there is the chitta, which is the memory, which is learnings from all the past mistakes or correct things done. And the ahankara, or the concept of who am I. So all these four functions, all these four, are the functions of the mind. But functionally they are divided, so it's not as if the mind is split into four quadrants and each quadrant performs one function. There are four functions of the mind, and depending on what function we are talking about, we call it with a different name. That is what we discussed, because in that whole satsang it was about that. Because on one hand Swami says mind is like a fly.
Right.
And on the other hand,
Swami's.
And Swami says manaiva manushanam karanam bandha mokshayo. So when Swami is speaking of mind as a fly, it's like the manas aspect which goes beyond pleasure. When it is manaiva manushanam karanam bandha mokshayo, meaning mind alone is responsible for your bondage or liberation, there it is the buddhi aspect of the mind which discriminates whether it should choose the world or God. So in that way, yes, mind is encompassing all these four functionalities.
Right, and the whole idea is, you know, it's very easy to, even in general Advaita philosophy or Vedanta, when somebody is seriously taking to the path of inquiry, this is what they say. It's very easy to discard the body as not being me, because it needs the most basic logic. And because you see corpse every day, you see, parts of somebody who has had a limb mutilated, and that person continues to be that person. Mm. These are all very simple examples by which you can go. But to dissociate yourself from the mind actually requires a little more sadhana and little more inquiry. And I think that's what Hislop is asking. It's very easy to discard the body as not being me. But how do I discard this mind as being me? Because even this thought is in this mind. And even this thought that I should understand, I should realize, I should do, everything is in the mind. And that's what Swami is saying. Yes, it is in the mind. The mind is the culprit. So the mind only has to undergo the transformation also. And as someone was saying, that we are so fixated. I was listening to a talk. We are so fixated with the idea that what I see is true. That now there is some research which has been going on. They are trying to show a person what is it that one person actually sees. Right? When you see a scene, when I'm seeing you sitting here, there is so much that the mind actually filters off from what the eye sees. Hmm. So many aspects of the world in front of you, what is seen, the mind actually filters out, saying that this would be too much information for the person to handle. So if you can create an instrument which is able to show you what you actually see, then you will understand how much you should not believe your eyes at all.
Hmm.
Right? Because all of our attributions, all of our understanding is based on I believe only what I see. This is to show that, you know, you actually cannot believe what you see, because what you believe, what you're seeing is a heavily truncated version of what you actually see, what is actually in front of you. So that'll be really fascinating to see that, you know, if you have the ability to see everything as it is, it'll be too overwhelming to take it.
I think Swami would quote one statement, which is, Pashyannapina Pashyati Mudho Mudho Mudho. O fool, you see and yet you do not see. I think usually that statement is understood as, at least I understand it as, there is God, we see, but yet we are not able to see him that way. But I think in the light of what you have said, it can have multiple meanings. We see and yet we do not see. So going ahead, it's actually Swami speaking on Jyoti meditation. I don't think we'll have time to finish the whole thing, but we'll just make a beginning now because we still have a few minutes left. Hislop says, Swami, in meditation, some of the Westerners are taking light alone, not the quite definite form of the jyoti or the lamps, the flame on the lamp, but just a formless light, and they're concentrating on it and projecting that. Is it correct to make formless light as the object of concentration? And Swami says, it is not practical to attempt to concentrate on that which has no form. To concentrate on the jyoti is an illustration. The object of concentration can be sound, can be light, the jyoti, etc. It needs to be something concrete. It is not easy to fix the mind on the abstract. I think that is one very nice pointer or thumb rule when we think of meditation. When we are beginning, it's not easy to fix the mind on the abstract. So we need a concrete thing. I'm saying this because there are some people in the Sai world who have popularized what is known as the thumb meditation. And then there are some who follow breath meditation. There are some who follow jyoti meditation. There are some others who meditate on the name and form of Swami. And like, you know, the normal humans that we are, we always want to know which is the easiest and the best. We want the cheap and best, the easiest, fastest and the best one, because I don't want to waste my time on other things. So the answer to that is, it definitely needs to be something concrete, because, and then Swami says, it is not easy to fix the mind on the abstract, which means we need something concrete on which we can fix the mind easily. And you know, pulling it, you know, extrapolating that same statement, why not take something that we love? Because fixing the mind on something we love is always easy. So, feel that thumb is such a pointless thing. You know, it's the index finger that's the pointing finger. Anyway, thumb is pointless, but thumb, I don't have any feelings towards it, you know. But Swami, I love. So in the same way for somebody else, the breath. It might be something that really excites them, enthuses them. So, sum and bonum of that is, it doesn't matter what is that concrete thing that I choose. You can as well choose a tree stump, a guitar, a dog's tail, whatever. But you should be able to fix your mind on it, and therefore it will help if it is something that is dear to you, because fixing the mind on something that is dear is always easier.
Right, as Swami would say, the whole idea of that initial step of meditation, you know, fixing it on either a thumb or an object or anything, or some people would give mantras. Sometimes the idea is taking away the fact that you can meditate on God, meditate on a form that you love. The problem with many of the objects that you can meditate on, or even a mantra, or even a name in that sense, everything is associated with some emotions or the other, or some thoughts. If you really observe thoughts, they can jump like, you know, that's why they give the monkey mind is given, because you can see the monkey jumping from one branch to the other and going so swiftly. And that's precisely what happens in the mind. You will suddenly pull yourself and say that, how did I get to this thought? Now, I was thinking of this and how did it go there? And then you can really see the trail how the mind goes. So one of the reasons why some of these objects are taken is there are no emotions attached to that. You know, you can think of it without anything. But the disadvantage of that is you're losing out on this beautiful opportunity to contemplate on God. As Swami would say, that when you think of a Rama or a Krishna or Swami, there are qualities associated with that form and name which are themselves purifying. You cannot think of Swami and think of a negative emotion. You cannot think of God and think of a narrow-mindedness. The moment you think of these forms, you think of love, you think of Jesus, you think of any form for that matter, you automatically think of compassion, you think of these good emotions. So even if your mind is going away in that sense, it will be something that will purify your impulses. But the advantage of taking an object which you're not emotionally attached to is that, you know, the opportunity to run away is less. As Swami would give a very beautiful example. Swami would say, there is a child in the house and you want to feed the child food. So what is the first thing that the mother does? And you know, nowadays you have nice chairs that can help you do that. Catch the child and pin him or her to one place, and you know, and lock that child up in the thing, and then you can feed. Then you can give whatever you're giving. So Swami would say meditation is that. The mind is running all over the place. These are all means by which you can catch that mind, pin that mind to one place, and then you can feed it with the right emotion that you can give. And that's what meditation is all about. So as in its own, it probably is only a technique.
Going ahead, actually, Swami is asked this question by Hislop. Is there a particular pathway along which the flame, the jyoti, should be moved in the body? And Swami goes into great detail to explain how to do the jyoti meditation. Those that are very eager and can't bear the suspense, you can find this. I won't give the hint which chapter it is, but it's in the book. You can locate and read it. Or else, please wait for us to come back next week and we will discuss this in great detail with giving it the due importance that it requires. So on that note, dear listeners, we will conclude this week's afternoon satsang. As always, you can write to us with your thoughts, feelings, whatever, at listener@radiosci.org. We will now conclude with a song, and on the other side of it will be the segment Love to Love.
Ram hai swanam dhan, Ram dhanya Ram, Ram ko pranam, Ram naam ko pranam. Ram bhajan karman, Ram bhajan karman, Ram bhajan karman, Ram भजन कर मन।